Chapter 3. The Bodhisattva Vow. So the bodhicitta has arisen. One has set out on the bodhisattva path, one's heart burning with the desire that all sentient beings may be free from suffering and attain enlightenment. But the arising of the bodhicitta is only the first of the 10 stages, or bhumis, of the bodhisattva's path to enlightenment. There is still a long way to go. What is the next step? This is relevant to all of us, whether the bodhicitta has arisen or not, because the bodhisattva's course of action once the bodhicitta has arisen is echoed in the spiritual practice of those in whom it has yet to arise. It is important to remember that it is the relative bodhicitta we are concerned with here. The absolute bodhicitta, as we have seen, is identical with enlightenment, above and beyond time and space. It is, in a sense, beyond our reach, in the realm of eternity. But the relative bodhicitta, the bodhicitta which manifests within the stream of time, is more accessible to us. It is traditionally said to have two aspects, a vow aspect and an establishment aspect. The establishment aspect involves what are known as the six paramitas, the six transcendental virtues or perfections, the practice of which moves the bodhisattva towards enlightenment: giving, uprightness, patience, vigour, meditation, and wisdom. These three pairs of virtues will be the subject matter of the next three chapters. First, though, we will consider the vow aspect of the relative bodhicitta. This is one of the most important practical aspects of the Mahayana tradition. The Sanskrit word being translated as vow is pranidhana, which can also be translated as resolution, determination, or pledge. Har Dayal suggests earnest wish, but that is perhaps too weak. Simply to wish that something may be so suggests that while one might like it to be so, one is not necessarily doing anything to make it happen. The bodhisattva does not simply wish that all sentient beings may attain enlightenment. He or she does everything within his or her power to bring that about. Hence, the pranidhana is not just a pious wish, it is a solemn and special vow. This vow is made publicly, and when it has been made, it can never, under any circumstances, be withdrawn. It may even be described as a sort of promise made by the bodhisattva upon the arising of the bodhicitta, a promise made to the universe at large, to all sentient beings. The fact that it is solemnly irrevocable is, of course, the essential characteristic of any vow. If one takes a vow and then breaks it, one can't really have been ready to make that step. A vow is a very serious kind of promise, and some people find even promises hard to keep. If one can't keep a promise to meet someone somewhere at a particular time, say, one is unlikely to be able to keep a vow. While to be scrupulous in keeping one's word in small things is good practice for the taking of a full-blown vow. If one is thinking of taking a vow of some kind, it is probably best to consult one's spiritual friends about it. With their knowledge of one's nature, perhaps better than one's own, they may have a better sense than one does oneself of whether one would be able to keep the vow one has in mind to take. Whatever the vow, whether it is to give up smoking, to observe lifelong celibacy, or to meditate for 2 hours every day, it needs to be tested out. It's a good idea to take it a bit at a time, perhaps for a month to begin with, then 2 months, 6 months, a year, and so on. Taking a vow publicly, in front of the assembled spiritual community or to a number of friends, gives it a weight and seriousness it might not otherwise possess. Having witnesses to one's vow helps one to keep it, because to break it would be to let them down as well as oneself. One extreme is to take vows rashly and lightly. The other is to avoid committing oneself at all. A middle way is to undertake personal precepts, again in consultation with one's spiritual friends. A precept falls short of a vow, but it can help one prepare to take a vow. Of course, as a Buddhist, one undertakes to observe 5 or 10 basic precepts anyway, and these are to be taken with full seriousness. One shouldn't be in a hurry to take vows before one is satisfied that one is observing the precepts as well as one can. And certainly one shouldn't be in a hurry to take the Bodhisattva vow. The nature of this vow is closely linked to the nature of the Bodhicitta. We have seen that the Bodhicitta is universal, but that it manifests in individuals and expresses itself through them. This expression of the Bodhicitta through the individual is what is known as the Bodhisattva's vow. The vow may therefore be defined as the concrete practical expression of the Bodhicitta in the life and work of the individual Bodhisattva. Although it is traditional to speak of the Bodhisattva's vow, the vow is generally a set of vows which varies from one Bodhisattva to another, reflecting his or her special interests and the aptitudes within the wider context of the Bodhisattva ideal. If we take the image of light refracted through a glass prism, the Bodhicitta is like pure white light shining through the prism, which represents the Bodhisattva, and the Bodhisattva vows are like the colours of the rainbow emerging on the other side. To take the simile further, we could say that the pure white light of the relative Bodhicitta streams from the sun of the absolute Bodhicitta and shines through hundreds and thousands of individual prisms, so that each produces its own combination of colours. Within the spectrum usually visible to us, the rainbow has only 7 colours. But some kinds of meditation involve trying to imagine, trying to see, to visualise other colours, colours one has never seen before. We can think of all these prisms as emitting not just the 7 colours we know, but hundreds of thousands of wonderful new colours. And similarly, we can imagine the Bodhicitta shining through the minds and hearts of different Bodhisattvas, producing innumerable combinations of vows. Together, the Bodhicitta and the Bodhisattva vow make provision for both unity and variety. The Bodhisattvas all participate in one Bodhicitta. This is the source of their unity. At the same time, each Bodhisattva expresses that one Bodhicitta in his or her own way. This individual expression in terms of life and work is what the Bodhisattva's vows consist in. We usually think of a vow as being verbal, like an oath taken in court. But it isn't just that the Bodhisattva makes a statement that he or she is going to do this or that. It's not even just a question of the Bodhisattva's conscious intention. To change the metaphor, we may say that the vows of the Bodhisattva are so many sparks struck not just from his or her mind or will, but from his or her total being under the tremendous impact of the Bodhicitta. The Mahayana scriptures mention many sets of vows, some of them associated with the names of great Bodhisattvas. For instance, there are the celebrated 48 vows of the Bodhisattva Dhammakara, who became the Buddha Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light. These 48 vows are enumerated at length in the larger Sukhavati Viewer Sutra, the Sutra of the Adornment of the Happy Land. The Dasabhumika Sutra, the Sutra on the 10 stages of the Bodhisattva's path, mentions 10 great vows. 1. To provide for the worship of all the Buddhas without exception. 2. To maintain the religious discipline that has been taught by all the Buddhas and to preserve the teaching of the Buddhas. 3. To see all the incidents in the earthly career of a Buddha. 4. To realize the thought of enlightenment, to practice all the duties of a Bodhisattva, to acquire all the paramitas, or perfections, and purify all the stages of his career. 5. to mature all beings, that is, all the four classes of beings in the six states of existence, and establish them in the knowledge of the Buddha. 6. To perceive the whole universe. 7. To purify and cleanse all the Buddha fields. 8. To enter on the great way, the Mahayana, and to produce a common thought and purpose in all bodhisattvas. 9. To make all actions of the body, speech and mind fruitful and successful. 10. To attain the supreme and perfect enlightenment and to preach the doctrine. These 10 vows are clearly different aspects of the Bodhisattva's determination to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. There is not the space here to examine all of them, but perhaps the third is worth dwelling on a little in order to explore specifically how we can approach them. One might wonder how anybody could vow to see all the incidents in the earthly career of a Buddha, but the traditional Mahayana presentation of the Bodhisattva career envisages that career as extending over 3 asamkhya kalpas, and therefore as covering innumerable lifetimes, during which one would be born during the lifetime of quite a number of different Buddhas, and could well be in contact with them in some way or another, perhaps even as a disciple. In the course of all those lifetimes, one would have the opportunity of seeing all the events in the life of a Buddha from the very beginning. According to general Buddhist teaching, the life of every Buddha follows a standard pattern. His mother always dies 7 days after his birth. He always has 2 chief disciples. He always gains enlightenment seated under a certain tree, and so on. At the time of his birth, you might be a god watching from heaven. Or to witness later events, you might be the charioteer of the Buddha-to-be, or one of his concubines, or one of his first 5 disciples. In one way or another, having taken this vow, you would be a witness to all the 12 great acts, as they are called, in a Buddha's life. This vow may seem neither relevant nor comprehensible, but one can at least try to grasp imaginatively what it means. There is no need to be in too much of a hurry to explain it away as being symbolic. It is good to allow oneself to linger over it and at least contemplate the possibility of taking it literally. In fact, the Mahayana tradition does take it quite literally. If one thinks in terms of hundreds and thousands and millions of lifetimes in which one practices the perfections, the paramitas, it is quite conceivable that one could be reborn during the lifetime of a Buddha. But if it is difficult to see this vow in this way, and for most of us it will be, another way we can approach it is to acquaint ourselves through literature with the life story of the Buddha. In considering the Buddha's life, though, one should be discerning about what one is going to try and emulate. It isn't necessary to think in terms of duplicating all the incidents of the Buddha's life. It is important to draw a distinction between those incidents that reflect stages of spiritual development and those that just happened because the Buddha was living in India during a certain period of history. It is perhaps best to regard this sort of vow as representing the archetype of a particular spiritual possibility in which one participates to one's own very limited extent. For most of us, it will be more effective simply to reflect it in our life as much as we can. It may be too much of a leap of the imagination to take a vow to witness the great events in the life of a Buddha, but one can certainly mentally review or imaginatively reenact those events and feel inspired by them. Likewise, the vow to perceive the whole universe is a vow that one cannot take literally, but one can take on board the underlying suggestion that one should see as much of reality as possible, see everything as clearly as one can. We do need to be quite careful here. it is hard enough to observe even the basic precepts of Buddhism. Thinking in terms of taking vows on this vast scale can amount to encouraging oneself to indulge in spiritual daydreaming, just fantasizing about observing all these wonderful vows, when one is not even practicing the precepts very seriously. Taking the Bodhisattva vows shouldn't represent some sort of Buddhistic Walter Mitty exercise. Otherwise, like Walter Mitty, one is going to come back to reality with a bump. So how are we to take the cosmic perspective the Mahayana offers? The idea, for example, that it takes three kalpas to traverse the Bodhisattva path. It may have the salutary effect of stretching one's imagination, but the principle we have to come back to is that the cosmic Bodhisattva ideal cannot be seen as pertaining to any given individual at all. To think that one could personally form that kind of aspiration is simply to fail to understand its real significance. As ordinary individuals, we can perhaps allow ourselves to think in terms of rebirth, even in terms of a series of rebirths extending over quite a long period of time. We can perhaps imagine ourselves as continuing our spiritual life through a succession of lives. But can we think in terms of a Bodhisattva career literally extending over three kalpas? A kalpa is a very long time. The traditional description of a kalpa asks us to imagine a rock a mile high, a mile wide, a mile long. Then we imagine that once every 100 years, someone comes and strokes a piece of Benares silk just once along the top of the rock. A kalpa is the amount of time it would take to wear down the whole rock at that rate. It is truly an immense period of time. Gampopa was a great Kagyu teacher, a Tibetan, at about the time of the Norman conquest in Britain. In his Jewel Ornament of Liberation, he quotes the Bodhisattva Bhumi, "I shall rejoice at staying in hell for thousands of aeons, if only to save one single being from misery, to say nothing of still longer periods and of still greater miseries." Such is a Bodhisattva's armour of strenuousness. So apparently the Bodhisattva volunteers for sojourns of millions of years in various hells for the sake of helping just one living being. But can we really imagine ourselves doing that? Surely it would be impossible for any human being to say that and sincerely believe it. If we try to imagine what the pains of hell would be like, we realise we wouldn't be able to stand even 1/100th part of that sort of pain. How can we take this as a workable aspiration for a real live human being? We find it difficult enough to help with washing the dishes sometimes. When the texts speak of the Bodhisattva in this way, it makes most sense to think that they are referring to some sort of cosmic trend or recognizing the existence of a potentiality for enlightenment, even under the most unfavorable circumstances. We find a similarly formidable prospect in the Precious Garland, in which Nagarjuna says, "A Bodhisattva stays for a limitless time in the world. For limitless embodied being, he seeks the limitless qualities of enlightenment and performs virtuous actions without limit." So here again we find a Mahayana text describing the Bodhisattva, the embodiment of the ideal we are exhorted to fulfill, but it doesn't seem at all practicable to us. Indeed, to judge from this description, the Bodhisattva hardly seems like a person at all. The impression one gets is that the Bodhisattva is beyond individuality, as we usually understand it, a disembodied, impersonal spiritual energy. This being the case, we can gather that the Mahayana isn't expecting us to behave in literally the manner described. We don't have to imagine ourselves performing infinite good deeds establishing Buddha fields, liberating infinite number of beings. It is more practical to take the Bodhisattva as representing a universal, even omnipresent spiritual energy at work in the universe, an energy we get a sense of every now and then. We can't literally think of being a Bodhisattva, but we can be open to the ideal, aspiring to be a channel for that energy within our own particular sphere. That is the most realistic, even the most honest way to see it. We have to stick very close to our actual situation. Otherwise we can get lost in unrealistic aspirations. It can all become a bit theatrical. And this does sometimes happen in the Mahayana countries of the Buddhist East. The Theravada is much more sober, much closer to the facts of the situation. But the Mahayana conveys very well the spirit of the whole process. The fact that this process takes place within a much wider, even a cosmic context. In the precious garland, Nagarjuna says, "Through faith in the Mahayana and through the practices explained therein, the highest enlightenment is attained, and along the way all pleasures." Why should there be all pleasures along the way on the Mahayana, as distinct from the Hinayana path? The difference, one can say simply, is the Bodhisattva ideal. The Hinayana speaks more in terms of giving things up, disciplining oneself, getting rid of craving, and so on. If the goal is mentioned at all, it is usually referred to in terms of the cessation of suffering or the cessation of craving. Not, for most people, a very inspiring prospect, not in the early stages of their spiritual life anyway. The Mahayana's ideal of the Bodhisattva is quite simply more inspiring. During the Buddha's lifetime, when the ideal was visibly present in the form of the Buddha himself, there was presumably no need to talk about it very much. But when the Buddha was no longer around, the ideal he represented had to be formulated somehow. Something had to be created to take the place of the actual presence of the Buddha. With the emergence of the Bodhisattva ideal, the Bodhisattva came to represent the sort of person you had to become if you wanted to be like the Buddha. It's all about vision. If one is to be inspired to build a Buddhist centre, to take that example, one will need to be given a vision of what one is creating. If one has a picture in one's mind of beautiful Buddha images, spacious, peaceful rooms, and a wonderful community of people, even if what one is doing is plastering a ceiling or knocking down a wall, one will be inspired to do it. If someone just came along and said, "Knock down that wall," that would feel entirely different. If one is doing what one is doing for the sake of a positive goal, one can work much more happily. Indeed, it becomes pleasure all the way. So we need to find a balance between vision and pragmatism. Perhaps the best solution is to take the two together. Take the Theravada for here and now, for daily practice, and the Mahayana as a guide to the ideal as it exists outside space and time, independent of one's own small efforts. All one really needs is a faith in the conservation of spiritual values beyond death. If one has that, one can be sure that if one practices the Dharma here and now, the future, how and where one will be reborn, whether or not one will become a Buddha in some distant world system, and so on, will look after itself. Perhaps one can't realistically make one's future Buddhahood the object of an aspiration. We need not take the Mahayana Sutras literally. They can be regarded as giving an inspiring glimpse of an archetypal world, but not as providing a pattern for Buddhist living in a detailed sense. One gets a much stronger sense of such a pattern from the Pali Canon. One can't appropriate to oneself as an individual, which really means as an ego, the attributes and qualities and activities and vows of a Bodhisattva. It is not that you or I, as individuals, are going to be Bodhisattvas in a cosmic sense. there is a bodhisattva, even the bodhisattva at work, and one does whatever one can to assist and cooperate with that work. Just as the Sambhogakaya Buddha, the archetypal Buddha, represents the ideal of enlightenment outside any historical context, in the same way the Bodhisattva represents not any historical individual, but what could be called the spirit of enlightenment at work in the world, personified in that Bodhisattva form. All this is to be borne in mind when it comes to approaching the Bodhisattva vows. Perhaps the most famous set of vows is the one known as the Four Great Vows. These are recited daily throughout the Far East, and they are usually given as follows. May I deliver all beings from difficulties. May I eradicate all passions. May I master all dharmas. May I lead all beings to Buddhahood. These vows are found in several Mahayana sutras, and it seems to be assumed that every practicing Mahayana Buddhist would wish to take them. In a way, they reflect the essence of the Bodhisattva ideal, in that if one takes the ideal seriously, one does try to function in these four ways. One could say that these vows are implicit, not just in the Bodhisattva ideal, but in Buddhism itself. They outline how all Buddhists should aim to behave all the time. But such extreme statements cannot be taken lightly. If one says, I vow to deliver all beings means all beings. It would seem better not to include utterances of this sort in a pucca which is recited regularly or habitually. The Mahayana's cosmic perspective is very valuable, but it does not lend itself to casual recitation. If one says the vows are part of one's individual private practice, presumably one is taking the recitation seriously. But just to have everybody who happens to be present in a shrine room reciting a vow to help all beings, to go no further than that, necessarily devalues that vow. The four great vows encompass the spiritual aspirations of many people, but one is not obliged to adopt this particular set. The scriptures make it clear that any individual bodhisattva is free to formulate a set of vows in accordance with his or her own aspirations within the general framework of the Bodhisattva ideal. The main consideration is that the vows should refer not to petty or immediate objectives, but to an ultimate, all-comprehensive aim. The great characteristic of all Bodhisattva vows is their universality. The altruistic dimension of the spiritual life has no limit. When one becomes aware of the altruistic implications of one's spiritual commitment, one sees that one can't impose any limit on those implications. One can't say, I'll do so much for other people, but no more. It may be that at present one is not able to do very much, but in principle one recognises no limitations to what one's commitment might require one to do for other people when one is in a position to do it. So when, in the traditional formulation of this first Bodhisattva vow, one says, I vow to save all living beings, what one is really saying is, I place no limit on what I am prepared to do for other living beings when the time is ripe and I am ready. One doesn't know what form one's aspiration is ultimately going to take or what one may need to do. One just remains open to helping people in any way one can. Inasmuch as there is no limit to egolessness, there is no limit to altruism. Just as one can't think in terms of getting rid of one's ego up to a certain point but no further, there can be no limit, in principle, to what one is prepared to do for other people. Once one has committed oneself to the spiritual life, one doesn't recognise any limitations at all, either subjectively or objectively. This is what the Bodhisattva vow is all about, a transcendence of limitations. In the Mahayana text called The Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 lines, There are many questions about how one can recognize a bodhisattva. One of the ways is apparently that whenever he is asked a question about nirvana, he always brings compassion into his reply. Translating that into more general terms, if, when one is asked a question about the spiritual life, one speaks only in terms of personal development, not mentioning the altruistic aspect, that suggests that one is not yet really on the spiritual path. We have to realize that our leading of the spiritual life can't be just for our own sake. It has implications for others and even imposes responsibilities on us with regard to others. In other words, we have to realize that compassion is coordinate with wisdom. It is significant that the Mahayana took it upon itself to bring out in a remarkable and dramatic way the altruistic implications of the spiritual life. And unfortunate that, due to historical developments, that came to be seen as constituting an alternative path rather than a reformulation of the original path. In Mahayana circles, people sometimes make very specific vows. For instance, someone might make a vow to publish the whole Tripitaka at their own expense and distribute it free. That might be a lifetime's work. Someone else might say, I will construct 100 stupas. Or, I will arrange for such and such a great teacher to deliver a series of lectures. Many vows take this kind of practical form. The idea is to strengthen oneself, to give oneself a bit of spiritual backbone. A vow is something to stick to protect one from getting lost in a mishmash of vague, quasi-spiritual aspirations. But if one is a bodhisattva, or would be bodhisattva, does one need these vows to enable one to stick to one's practice of the paramitas? Well, if as yet one has no more than an intellectual conviction about the bodhicitta, albeit a conviction that one holds sincerely and in accordance with which one tries to live, then one will need the vows. If the bodhicitta has not yet arisen as an actual experience parallel to transcendental insight, the vows will be needed as supports. But once the bodhicitta has arisen, one's vows are the expression of it rather than a support to it. It is important not to distinguish too rigidly between the bodhicitta and the vows through which it expresses itself. It is not that the bodhicitta arises and then one bethinks oneself that perhaps one ought to take a few vows. The vows are natural expressions of the arisen bodhicitta, the various perspectives that one sees opening up before one now that the bodhicitta has arisen. According to tradition, when the bodhisattva makes his vow, consequent on the arising of the bodhicitta, the Buddha in whose presence he makes it predicts him to eventual enlightenment and mentions, perhaps, the name by which he will be known as a Buddha, and also the name of his Buddha land or Buddha field. If one doesn't take this literally, and perhaps it can be taken literally on a certain level, one has to somehow interpret its meaning as a myth. One could perhaps say that the Buddha's prediction of that bodhisattva to supreme enlightenment represents a sort of echo coming back from the whole universe in response to the vow. The universe is involved in that vow. It is affected by it. And presumably, if it is a moral come spiritual universe, it has some awareness of that. The bodhisattva's vow is a public affair, as it is part of and affects the public reality. There is a response. In a way, the prediction represents the fact that the universe as a whole underpins or even underwrites one's vow. This is the kind of universe within which the realization of the vow is possible, and in a sense even inevitable, once it has been made. The Buddha simply gives expression to that. From his perspective, beyond time, the Buddha looks into time and predicts the future. But that prediction does not mean that the bodhisattva is sure to gain enlightenment. This is parallel to the difficulty in Christian theology of reconciling man's free will with God's foreknowledge. The fact that the Buddha predicts the bodhisattva to enlightenment doesn't mean that from then onwards the Bodhisattva has no freedom. The Buddha, from outside time, may see that the Bodhisattva will become enlightened. But the Bodhisattva can't just ride on the crest of that prediction. From his or her own temporal point of view, he or she will still have to make a definite effort towards the goal. This idea can be translated into simpler terms. Going for refuge to the three jewels, for instance. When one goes for refuge in the presence of the assembled Sangha, that doesn't predict one's spiritual progress, but it does support it. One realizes that one is not alone. There is a response. By rejoicing in one's merits, the Sangha is effectively giving one an assurance of further progress. In fact, lofty as it sounds, the first of the four great vows, may I deliver all beings from difficulties, difficulties here meaning worldly difficulties, is a pragmatic starting point. It's as though whoever framed these vows is saying to the would-be Bodhisattva, for the moment, forget about helping people spiritually. Few are qualified to offer help at this level, and even for them it is by no means plain sailing to help people in the right way. Many people ask for spiritual guidance, but hardly any are able to receive and act upon it. The Sutra of 42 sections says, it is hard to help others towards enlightenment according to their various needs. Even for a Buddha, it is difficult to see people's true needs. The Pali Canon recounts an incident in which the Buddha taught some monks the recollection on death, only for them to go off and commit suicide. A useful general rule is to help people in ways that are as simple and basic as possible. One can't go far wrong in giving someone a meal or their bus fare, unless they're going off to commit a crime or something. But anything more complicated can be problematic. On the other hand, although practical human needs should be attended to first, in a way, they can be more difficult to sort out than basic spiritual needs. One can be fairly sure that meditation will be good for people, if one can get them to practice it and one is qualified to teach it. But it may be quite difficult to tell whether it would be good for Mrs. Brown to move to Bournemouth or for Mr. Bloggs to marry a second time. It is perhaps significant that in most Buddhist countries, especially Theravada countries, usually only the most senior and experienced bhikkhus within the monastic order are permitted to advise the laity with regard to their worldly affairs. After all, what is help? It certainly isn't just telling people what to do, although some people think so. In fact, it may not involve interacting directly with them at all. Very often, if one is just being oneself, if one is positive and inspired and getting on with one's own spiritual life, that can help others without one's even realising it. Listening can be very helpful, of course. It helps people to clarify their thoughts, to become conscious of their desires and wishes, and to consider all the factors involved in whatever they are talking about. Sometimes, after one has been listening to someone for a while, at the end of the conversation they say in all sincerity, "This talk has really helped me." Perhaps one hasn't said a word, but it is as though they have been given very good advice, because being listened to has allowed them to clarify their thoughts. It is best to start by helping in a down-to-earth way. Everybody can give at least some material, tangible help to other people. It is therefore said, under the heading of this particular vow, that the would-be Bodhisattva should be sympathetic and helpful in the affairs of everyday life on all occasions. A friendliness which can extend not just to human beings, but to animals as well. If one shows a lack of consideration for others, that must be because one doesn't appreciate how they feel, or the position, even the predicament they are in. Very often we are so bound up with our own affairs, interests and preferences, that we are oblivious to the needs and feelings of others. To cultivate fellow feeling, therefore, one needs awareness of other people, together with imagination, a willingness to put oneself into others' shoes. To take an everyday example, if someone pays you a visit, it is important to make sure they are properly introduced to others present and that they feel at ease. In new surroundings, they may be feeling a little uncertain and in need of reassurance. Then again, if you receive a letter and don't reply, the writer will be wondering what has happened, even whether you got the letter at all. You may have a perfectly good reason for not replying, but they don't know that. As well as feeling with people, it is important to feel for them, appreciating their good qualities as well as their limitations, not always thinking of them in terms of what needs to be changed. Often we are simply not kind enough to one another. Perhaps in our culture we've become so preoccupied with ourselves, what we want, what is due to us, our rights, that we've forgotten the basic human kindness. So to begin with, one can leave aside concerns about other people's spiritual development. There's no need either to think in terms of performing great heroic deeds, although circumstances may sometimes demand that. One can start by paying attention to the small details of life. If you burn the rice, or produce lunch late, or borrow someone's favourite book and forget to tell them, or let the door slam, all those things are going to make life unpleasant for someone else. On the other hand, if you take care with preparing food for someone, or give them a book, or make a special effort to move around quietly, that will have a positive effect. We need to practice kindness and mindfulness in all these little ways, making sure that we are not so preoccupied with dealing with our own mental states that we lose all awareness of what is going on around us. Of course, it isn't just our own mental states that preoccupy us. Very often, what we are intent on is what we can get from another person. When the Buddha asked the other monks why they didn't look after the monk who had dysentery, they said he was no use to them. What a terrible admission. So often this is the reason for our lack of kindness towards people. They are of no use to us. We don't get anything from them. It's all very well to talk about the Dharma, practicing meditation, enlightening all beings, and all the rest of it, but we can start with just being kind to one another. Auden speaks of our kindness to 10 persons, and even that is quite an achievement. But it need not stop there. There should be an element of kindness in our attitude to everybody we meet. At least we should have goodwill towards them and do what we can for them in small ways. Having said that, one should be careful not to be too prematurely bodhisattva-like, flitting around helping people. It is possible to end up being like the Boy Scout who helped the old lady across the road as his good deed for the day. When he told the scoutmaster what he'd done, the scoutmaster said, "Well, that's not much of a good deed. That's a very easy thing to do." To which the boy riposted, "No, it wasn't. She didn't want to cross." Let us beware forcible philanthropies of that nature. Even when it comes to encouraging people, some caution is needed. Perhaps the best thing is just to be oneself, acting as skillfully and positively as one can. That will encourage others to behave skillfully, without one's having to take it upon oneself to advise them about the right thing to do. We can help people a great deal by thinking about them positively and developing metta towards them. And sometimes we can help people just by keeping out of their way, or rather by not getting in their way. Sometimes people need space, and we help them most by giving it to them, or at least not taking it from them. But those who take the Bodhisattva vow seriously will not be satisfied with being helpful in the affairs of everyday life, useful and necessary though that is. We should be prepared to go a little further, even go a little out of our way, to help those in difficulties. We may even need to be prepared to undergo some discomfort. This is the kind of thing the Bodhisattva Bhumi is getting at when it describes the Bodhisattva as putting on the armour of strenuousness. One's enthusiasm for the vision one has been given allows one to ignore, even be unaware of, not only minor discomforts, but even pain. If one is a bodhisattva, or would-be bodhisattva, One's wish to help others is so intense that one doesn't mind difficulties for oneself. Something of this attitude has to inform anything one does for others that involves taking a bit of trouble. One can't do anything with or for other people without at least a touch of the Bodhisattva ideal to keep one going. Otherwise there will be a reaction sooner or later. Resentment will set in the moment one feels taken for granted. One can even start hating the people one is trying to help. At the very least, it will feel a strain. But the Bodhisattva feels no tension or strain because he or she is acting on the basis of the arisen bodhicitta. The Bodhicitta Vivarana says, "One who understands the nature of the bodhicitta sees everything with a loving heart, for love is the essence of the bodhicitta." All bodhisattvas find their raison d'etre in this great loving heart. It's the bodhicitta that makes the bodhisattva. However altruistic one is or tries to be, one is not a bodhisattva if that transcendental dimension hasn't entered one's being. It could even be said that only when the bodhicitta has arisen is one really on the spiritual path. Until then, one is just preparing the ground. But whether or not the bodhicitta has arisen, there are certainly a great many people in need of help, and we should not delay in helping where we can. There are certain groups of people who are perhaps especially in need of whatever help we can give them. First of all, old people are often in need of help. Many of them have to live alone, and they often, not unnaturally, feel lonely and neglected. If one can offer a few old people in one's neighbourhood a bit of warm human contact on a regular basis, it may make a great deal of difference to their lives. Then there are the sick. Not just those who are down with flu for a couple of days, though they need help too, but especially those who are confined to hospital, sometimes with serious painful diseases for long periods of time. It sometimes happens that after a while, even their closest relations begin to neglect them, thinking, "Ah, well, I can go next week or the week after. After all, old so-and-so is there all the time. They don't go away." In the end, they may stop visiting altogether. Many hospital patients, especially those who have been there a long time and those who are old, have no relations or friends to visit them. So this is something very practical we can do. Then, what about those confined to prison for one reason or another? We may not be able to visit them, but we could write. A lot of prisoners get a great deal of support from people writing to them and helping them to keep in touch with what is happening outside, helping them to feel that they still belong to the world, to which one day they will have to return. Also, those who are suffering mentally in one way or another need help and support. Many people whose psychological balance is disturbed need expert help. We certainly shouldn't try to do more than we are qualified to do. But it may be that simple friendliness will help someone a great deal. Much mental distress is due to a lack of communication with other people, a lack of any opportunity to disclose oneself. In such cases, befriending someone and making it possible for them to talk about what's on their mind can be very helpful. I once read about a catatonic patient in a mental hospital who didn't respond at all, ever, to anybody or anything. But there was a young nurse in the ward who became convinced that he could be brought to respond. So every day she simply took his hand and held it for half an hour. She did this for 6 months without any response at all. But then one day the patient squeezed her hand in return, and that was the turning point. Over a period of a few months, she was able to open up some sort of communication with him, and in the end he came out of his catatonic state. Such things are possible. In psychotherapy, one of the main factors that contributes to helping the patient is that the analyst is listening to them. Ordinary doctors are sometimes put in this position. The person who comes ostensibly as a patient is just desperate for someone to talk to. we shouldn't underestimate the value of simple communication. And sometimes expert help doesn't help. Psychotherapy can help people in many ways. But in cases where there are symptoms of some deeper existential disturbance, psychotherapy in the ordinary medical sense may not help much. The effectiveness of a system of psychotherapy depends very much on the ideas it is based on, especially its idea of what it is to be a human being. If you have a limited view of human beings, you cannot help having a limited view of mental illness, and therefore a limited view of psychotherapy. There is a great difference between somebody who sees a human being as a potential Buddha and somebody who sees a human being merely as a rational animal, or even an irrational one. Today's schools of psychotherapy are increasingly aware of the need to help people confront existential problems. We are ultimately spiritual beings, and if our need for spiritual life is frustrated, that may result in mental distress. There will always be people whose psychological problems call for therapy rather than meditation. But ultimately, there is no such thing as a psychological solution. In the long run, the key to mental health is not psychological but spiritual. In any case, communication is always the key factor, and whenever our friendship may help someone in psychological difficulties, we should not hesitate to offer it. There are, of course, many other kinds of people to whom we can offer help. Refugees, the homeless, the starving, the underprivileged all over the world. It is difficult to help directly. Not everybody can just go off to Africa or India, but we may be able to help indirectly through a charity. There is so much that can be done if we have the will and the heart to do it. And this is the first thing that the Bodhisattva sets out to do, to help living beings, human beings and animals, out of their immediate, practical, material difficulties. At this stage, one doesn't presume to think of leading anybody to enlightenment. To begin with, it's enough to give them a helping hand in the affairs of everyday life according to one's capacities. However, whether or not we are qualified to give spiritual help and guidance, this is what many people in the modern West do need more than anything else. If we ourselves are not in a position to give that sort of help directly, we can give it indirectly. By helping those who can give it, perhaps by freeing them from other responsibilities, or providing facilities of some kind. For example, a good writer or a good meditation or Dharma teacher will very often need financial support if they are to put their valuable gifts to best use. If one does find a way of expressing this vow, one should be careful to avoid the feelings that the way one has found is the only way. Years ago, when I was working among the most socially deprived Buddhists in India, often treated as untouchables, I met a man on a train who in no uncertain terms expressed the opinion that I was wasting my time. According to him, the people who needed help were the lepers, and I ought to be devoting my time to them. Well, I could see his point, but he couldn't see mine. I certainly didn't feel that it was wrong for him to be working among the lepers, or that he should be working among the Neo-Buddhists instead. But he could not see that working for the Neo-Buddhists might be just as valid as working for the lepers. Indeed, the only way we can extend the relief of suffering in the world is by taking an interest where others have not yet done so. The second great vow is, may I eradicate all passions. So what are the passions and how are they to be eradicated? The term covers all mental defilements, that is all negative emotions, psychological conditionings, prejudices and preconceptions. There are several traditional lists of these passions. First, there are the three unwholesome roots, craving, hatred and ignorance, symbolized by the cock, the snake and the pig, depicted in the center of the Tibetan Wheel of Life. In any depiction of the wheel, with all its circles and subdivisions, right at the center, right at the hub of our own lives, are these three creatures, each one biting the tail of the one in front. These are the driving forces of our existence. Another list of passions is the five nivaranas, the five hindrances to meditation. Desire for sense experience, ill will, restlessness and anxiety, sloth and torpor, and doubt and indecision. Then there are the five poisons, distraction, anger, craving, conceit, and ignorance. The word poison is apposite. Negative emotions are literally poisonous, and when we indulge in them, we literally poison our system. Sometimes when one is overpowered by a strong negative emotion, especially anger or hatred, one gets a stabbing pain in the stomach or the heart. This is the poison eating into one's vitals. The best way to eradicate the passions is to attack them at source, like stopping the activities of a band of robbers by destroying their hideout, to use a traditional illustration. One has to find the centre of operations of the passions, which is, of course, the mind. That's where they are to be rooted out. And this is one of the effects of meditation. There are five basic meditation exercises in the Buddhist tradition which act as antidotes to the five poisons. The first poison to be dealt with is distraction, the tendency of the mind to jump from one thing to another. Having a butterfly mind so that one can't settle on one thing steadily for any length of time. In T.S. Eliot's famous line, we are distracted from distraction by distraction. The antidote to this mental state is the meditation practice called the mindfulness of breathing, which involves watching the breath to achieve a one-pointed concentration on the breathing process. The second of the five poisons is anger, said to be the most un-bodhisattva-like of all passions. You can give way to craving and desires, you can steal and lie, and in your heart of hearts you may still be a bodhisattva. But if you lose your temper, bang goes all your bodhisattvahood, and you have to start all over again. The reason is that anger is directly opposed to the spirit of compassion. In his Shiksha Samuchaya, Shantideva says, to paraphrase, "Well, here you are, promising to deliver all beings from difficulties and be kind and compassionate to them, and then what do? You go and get angry with one of them. There can't be much substance to your bodhisattva vow." The bodhisattva is advised to avoid anger at all costs. The antidote to anger is again quite simple. It's the metta bhavana, the development of universal loving kindness. This meditation is one of four practices called the Brahma Viharas, the sublime abodes. The other three being the cultivation of compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. The metta practice was first taught by the Buddha, as recorded in the very beautiful Metta Sutta. A fuller description of the practice is given by Buddha Gosha in his Visuddhimagga, the Path of Purity. One starts the practice by developing a feeling of loving kindness towards oneself, wishing that one may be well, happy, and free from suffering. Then one extends that feeling to a close friend, then to a person one can visualize but doesn't know well, perhaps someone at work or someone one sees every day at the bus stop, and then to someone with whom one has difficulties. The fifth and last stage of the practice involves extending one's metta equally to all four people, oneself, one's friend, the neutral person, and the enemy, and then allowing the feeling to radiate out to those in the surrounding area, then wider and wider, until one's metta is flowing out to all beings, animals as well as human beings, wherever they may be in the world or the universe. The metta bhavana is a beautiful practice, though one which many people find extremely difficult. But if one perseveres, one can be confident that anger and hatred will gradually be dispelled through the deliberate, mindful development of love and goodwill towards all living beings. Thirdly, we come to craving. This is not just desire, but neurotic desire. Take food, for instance. We all have a desire for it. It is natural to have a healthy appetite. But that desire has become neurotic if we find ourselves trying to use food to satisfy some other need. As is all too obvious, craving is a big problem. It creates drug addiction, alcoholism, and a host of other problems. The vast advertising industry is geared to stimulating craving, trying to convince us, with or without our knowledge, that we must have this, that, or the other thing. There are several practices designed to reduce craving. Perhaps the number reflects the scale of the problem. Some of these antidotes, it must be said, are quite drastic. For instance, there's the contemplation of the 10 stages of the decomposition of a corpse. This is still a popular practice in some Buddhist countries. It is said to be especially good as an antidote for neurotic sexual desire. I won't describe the practice itself. That would make for rather gruesome reading. But there is a milder version, which is simply to meditate alone at night in a cremation ground. Indian cremation grounds are not pretty places. You get fragments of charred bone and cloth lying around, and usually there's a stench of burning human flesh lingering in the air. But to meditate there can be a beneficial and even exhilarating practice. The effect can be to make one very peaceful, almost as though one's own cremation had already taken place. Indeed, within the Hindu tradition, the custom is symbolically to perform one's own funeral service at the point when one finally leaves the household life. In this way, one becomes a sannyasin, one who renounces the world and lives totally without possessions, solely for the realization of liberation. The idea is that when the sannyasin gives up the world, he no longer exists as far as the world is concerned. So the last thing he does before going off in his yellow robe is conduct his own funeral ceremony. It is the same association of death with renunciation and the eradication of all worldly cravings that is made in the meditation on the decomposition of a corpse. If even the occasional visit to the cremation ground is too much, of course our Western versions of these places, graveyards, are not usually so elemental. For a still milder form of the same practice, one can simply meditate on the reality of death. One can reflect that death is inevitable. It comes to everybody in due course. No one can escape it. So since it must come, why not make the best possible use of one's life? And here, we get to the main point of the reflection. Why indulge in miserable cravings that don't bring any satisfaction or happiness in the long run? One can also meditate upon impermanence. Everything is impermanent. From the solar system to one's own breath, from instant to instant, everything is changing, flowing, transient. When one remembers this, one can view things as being like clouds passing through the sky. One can't hang on to anything very determinedly when one knows that sooner or later one will have to give it up. Every day the newspapers are full of reports of fatal accidents, and this gives, as well as the occasion for compassion, an opportunity for reflection. Human life is liable to unexpected termination. One may not live to a ripe old age. As Pascal said, just a grain of dust is sufficient to destroy us if it gets into the wrong place. Life is very precarious. Such reflections can be sobering and fruitful, but they will be counterproductive if what they produce is a kind of neurotic timidity. One has to be sensitive to one's own nature in this regard. A skull or a few bones, preferably human ones, can also be useful objects of reflection. It may sound strange or even amusing, We are sometimes inclined to laugh at death to cover up our fear of it, but this is standard practice among Tibetan Buddhists. Of course, we have a precedent for it in the Western tradition, in Hamlet's contemplation of Yorick's skull in Shakespeare's play. In fact, Tibetans tend to surround themselves with all kinds of things made of human bone. Bone rosaries, thigh bone trumpets, skull cups. They take a common sense view of death. They don't think there's anything morbid or macabre about it. In the West, though, the very word death is supposed to send a shiver down one's spine. Not that the Christian tradition avoids the straightforward facts of death. Many ancient tombstones bear representations of skeletons and skulls. In some burial places, bones are kept for visitors to see, and monks practice the constant recollection of death. Corpses are laid out for friends and relations of the dead person to come and have a look. And of course, there is the tradition of the wake. Indeed, if we sweep death under the carpet in our modern culture, perhaps it is partly because the Christian tradition is less important to us than it used to be. The problem in our culture is not really denial, but the tendency to identify the total self with the body, even when the soul has departed. According to some kinds of popular Christianity, the teaching of the resurrection of the body means the literal resuscitation of the corpse. It follows that when a man is buried, the worms are eating him. Not just his body, but him. This identification of the decomposing corpse with the deceased person gives death a peculiar sort of horror mixed with fascination. But this is not the Buddhist way of looking at death, nor, come to that, the Hindu or Muslim way of looking at it. After all, death is just as natural as life. Tagore, the great modern Bengali poet, says, "I know I shall love death because I have loved life." Life and death are opposite sides of the same thing. If you love life, you will love death. And if you can't love death, you haven't really loved life. It sounds paradoxical, but it is deeply true. When it comes to counteracting craving, one should select whichever exercise is appropriate to one's needs. For many people, the sight of a decomposing corpse would just give rise to feelings of disgust and revulsion. One might be physically sick, but not affected spiritually at all. One has to be sufficiently mature spiritually to be able to absorb the lesson, to be impressed by the fact of impermanence, not merely shocked or disgusted. If one is sensitive enough, even the falling of a leaf will bring home the truth of impermanence. Perhaps each of us needs to experiment a little. Is a falling leaf enough? Or keeping a skull in one's room? This is something Tibetan Buddhists often do. Or does one need something stronger? Perhaps one might need to try another traditional antidote to craving, the contemplation of the loathsomeness of food. I won't go into the details of this practice either. They are rather unpleasant, deliberately so. Suffice to say that it is a powerful antidote to food addiction. The fourth poison is conceit, sometimes translated as pride, but conceit is the more effective translation. Conceit is said to be particularly associated with the human realm, as opposed to the other five realms of existence depicted on the Tibetan Wheel of Life. The human realm is characterized by self-consciousness, and when one experiences oneself as separate from other people, one may feel not only separate, but isolated. Not only isolated, but superior. It is plain that there is less likelihood of conceit in the other realms depicted on the Wheel of Life. It is hardly possible to have a conceited animal, though some dogs, no doubt through human influence, seem to have a conceited air. A preta, a hungry ghost, is just so hungry that it doesn't have a chance to think about how it compares with others. It's hard to imagine a preta thinking, "I'm hungrier than you are," or come to that, a being in hell thinking, "I'm suffering more than you are." Suffering is a serious business. Asuras and gods could possibly be imagined to be conceited because they, like human beings, have self-consciousness. But perhaps the gods are too self-satisfied. They are not so anxious that they need to compare themselves with others, while the asuras are too busy fighting. So conceit is a very human weakness. According to the Buddha, thinking in terms of one's status in relation to others in any way, whether one concludes that one is superior, inferior, or equal, is a form of conceit. It is perhaps surprising at first that the Buddha should have said this, but a little reflection makes it clear that egalitarianism, insisting that everyone is equal, and self-conscious humility, insisting that others are superior to oneself, are both inverted forms of conceit. Someone may present themselves as a lover of equality when what they really want to do. Someone may present themselves as a lover of equality when what they really want to do is bring everybody else down to their own level. This is a great weakness and a great loss. If there is nobody above one, spiritually speaking, one has nobody to look up to or learn from. So it is going to be very difficult to make spiritual progress. Conversely, if one adopts a fixed position of inferiority, one denies one's own potential, and the negation of the possibility of spiritual development is a very serious thing. The traditional antidote to conceit is to meditate on the six elements: earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness, listed in increasing order of subtlety. Note 102. For the purposes of meditation, the six elements can be represented symbolically by geometric forms, visualized one on top of the other, so as to create a mental image of the Buddhist symbol and architectural form known as the stupa. Earth is represented by a cube, which is the base of the stupa, water by a sphere, which comes on top of the cube, fire by a cone on top of the sphere, air by a bowl shape representing the firmament, space by a flame in that bowl, and consciousness by the space in which the whole thing stands. Alternatively, one can engage in a series of reflections. First of all, you meditate upon the element earth. You reflect, in my own body there is earth, the solid element, flesh, bone, and so on. But where does it come from? It comes from the earth element, the solid matter in the universe. And when I die, my physical body is going to crumble, dissolve, return to the earth. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Next, you reflect on the water element. You think, in me there is blood, there are tears, there is sweat, and so on. This is the water element. Where does it come from? It doesn't belong to me. It's just part of the water element in the universe, like the rain, the rivers, the lakes, and the seas. One day I'll have to give it back. One day the liquid element in me will flow back into the liquid element in the universe. Thirdly, you meditate on the element fire. In me there is heat, there is warmth, but where does it come from? What is the great source of heat for the whole world? It's the sun. Without the heat of the sun, the whole solar system would be cold and dark. The warmth in me, too, comes from that source, and when I die, it will return to the universe. I've borrowed it for a while, but in due course I'll have to give it back. Then you consider the element air. What is the air element in me? It's the air in my lungs. I'm taking it in and giving it out, giving it back, every instant. But it doesn't really belong to me. Just like the rest of me, the solid part, the watery part, the fiery part, the air element isn't mine. I borrow it just for a few instants, then I have to give it back. One day, when I breathe out, I won't breathe in again. I will finally have given back my breath. And just as the air element won't belong to me then, in fact, it doesn't belong to me now. Fifthly, you meditate upon space. You reflect that your physical body occupies a certain space. This is the space I occupy. identify myself with it. But when the physical body disintegrates, what will become of the space I have occupied? It will merge into the vast space around and disappear. And then, what about consciousness? You think, at present, part of my consciousness depends upon the eye, part upon the ear, and so on. When there's no eye, no ear, no physical body, where will that consciousness be? When my present individuality, as I experience it, ceases to exist, where will the consciousness associated with that individuality be? Reflecting in this way, you attempt to withdraw from the different levels of consciousness associated with the physical body, and thus to realize higher and higher levels of consciousness. This shift arises quite naturally out of the previous stages of the six-element practice. You have already envisaged the four elements that make up your physical body as occupying a certain space, and when those elements are no longer present, that space is no longer delineated. Associated with one's physical body is a certain consciousness, and when the physical body and the space it was occupying are no longer there, the consciousness can no longer be associated with that physical body or with that space. If there is no demarcated space for consciousness to be associated with, it cannot associate itself with an undemarcated space, i.e. an infinite space, either. It can only proceed infinitely outwards, not finding any line of demarcation or any material body with which to identify. In this way, meditation practices like this one culminate ultimately in a kind of spiritual death, in which individual consciousness dies into universal consciousness, and in a sense realizes its everlasting identity with it. As the Tibetans say, the sunlight returns to and merges into the mother light. The classic opportunity for the transition to an experience of universal consciousness is the time of death. But unless one has already had some experience of this kind in meditation, one is unlikely to be able to sustain it for more than an instant after death, if indeed it happens at all, for it isn't an automatic part of the death process. In fact, dead or alive, it is almost impossible for us to imagine what this experience might be like. One way to approach it when doing the six-element practice is to take universal consciousness as a poetic image. Many people find the traditional image of the dewdrop slipping into the shining sea very helpful. More prosaically, one can think of all limitations to consciousness being removed, so that it becomes infinite in all directions. The essential thing is to have the experience of an infinite expansion of consciousness. One shouldn't take this image of the smaller consciousness merging into the greater too literally. The metaphor of a dewdrop slipping into the sea, shining or otherwise, is just a metaphor. The infinite expansion of consciousness is so difficult to describe, because if one were to experience it fully, one would become enlightened. Infinite consciousness is the enlightened state. Furthermore, as the Madhyamikas would be careful to add, this infinite consciousness is an empty consciousness. That is, it is not an entity or thing. The physical universe isn't excluded from this infinite consciousness, but it doesn't constitute a barrier to it. It's as though one's consciousness goes through it. It is not that something literally isn't there that was there before, but it is no longer seen as an obstacle. It becomes transparent, as it were. The six-element practice, leading as it does to this perception of reality, is a direct negation of one's usual grasping, ego-based tendency. It helps one to dissolve the idea of one's own individuality in the narrow sense of the world, and thus destroys the poison of conceit. The fifth poison is ignorance, by which is meant spiritual ignorance, unawareness of reality. In a sense, this is the basic poison, the raw ingredient from which all the others are made. The traditional antidote for ignorance is meditation on the nidanas, the links of conditioned co-production. This formulation gives us a way of reflecting on the truth of conditionality, that independence upon A, B arises. It asks us to see that from our ignorance flows a whole chain of events. One could say that it's a reflection on the workings of the law of karma. Buddhist tradition enumerates many lists of these links, one of the best known being the chain of 12 links depicted around the rim of the Tibetan Wheel of Life. This chain begins, really a beginningless beginning, with ignorance, and ends with decay and death. As well as the 12 nidanas pertaining to conditioned existence depicted on the Wheel of Life, there are another 12, the nidanas pertaining to, or at least leading to, the unconditioned existence, nirvana. The 12 worldly nidanas represent the cyclical type of conditionality, the Wheel of Life, and the reactive mind, while the 12 spiritual nidanas represent the spiral type of conditionality, the stages of the path, and the creative mind. These five poisons and their antidotes give us just one way of considering the negative mental states we need to overcome and the ways we can do this. But basically, as novice bodhisattvas, we need all the means at our disposal, and the Buddhist tradition offers us a great many to work towards the eradication of all passions and the fulfillment of the bodhisattva's second great vow. The third great vow is, may I master all dharmas. By dharmas here is meant primarily the teachings of the Buddha, as contained within the scriptures and all the other teachings of all the Buddhist schools. Bodhisattvas don't belong to this school as opposed to that school. They don't even belong to the Mahayana as opposed to some other yana. They belong to, they study, they master the teachings of all schools, all sects, and all traditions. Not only that, bodhisattvas, we are told, should also study and master even the non-Buddhist religious and philosophical systems. Some scriptures go as far as to say that bodhisattvas should study secular arts and sciences, especially rhetoric and prosody, which were much in favour during the Indian Middle Ages, to increase their power of communication. A few of the sutras even say that bodhisattvas should master various trades, such as the trade of the potter. The idea is that knowing the vocabulary and outlook of these trades gives one a new frame of reference. Knowing the sort of language, both literal and metaphorical, that people use, one is able to communicate one's point of view, one's attitudes, ideals, and aspirations more and more effectively to more and more people. If one is involved in communicating the Dharma in any way, one tends to need all sorts of skills. To run a Buddhist centre, for example, people are needed who, in addition to being committed to the Bodhisattva ideal, are good at administration and know something about accounts and about law. To run a residential community requires people with knowledge of building, repair and decoration, wiring and plumbing, gardening and cooking. One can add to the list almost indefinitely. Commitment to the Bodhisattva ideal, in short, includes putting one's skills at the service of that ideal. To teach the Dharma, one may need other skills too. One may need to learn to speak effectively and clearly, not just if one is in the position of giving public talks, but also in conversation. One might develop skills to communicate the Dharma in other ways too, writing articles, reviews or books, or giving interviews on radio and television. One might develop one's artistic skills to produce paintings of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, frescoes or Buddha images. Or one might acquire editorial skills, including a command of grammar, punctuation and so on. One might go into book production or editing magazines or taking photographs or translation or learning to speak a second language. Or one might acquire academic experience in order to influence and draw on new areas of research and learning. Mastering all dharmas implies gaining both breadth and depth of experience. It's useful to have a working knowledge of a lot of things, but there should be at least one or two things, whether they are practical skills or areas of study, which one knows really well. And wherever our interests take us, we need to carry our basic Buddhist principles with us, so that we have something to which we can relate our broadening knowledge. Otherwise, it will be no more than a recollection of miscellaneous bits and pieces of information, even if Buddhist principles have an honoured place among them. To begin with, it is like doing a jigsaw puzzle. It isn't exactly clear how all the pieces fit together, but gradually a complete picture emerges. A collection of unrelated pieces of information is not knowledge. Knowledge is being able to refer things to their principles, creating a sort of cosmos out of the chaos of human experience. To say that the Bodhisattva should master all the Buddha's teachings, all the numberless religious and philosophical systems, as well as the study of the secular arts and sciences and various trades, is obviously to ask a great deal. What are we to make of such a grand ambition? On the mythic level, the Bodhisattva's career, as we have seen, is envisaged as covering 3 asamkhyas of kalpas, which would give him or her a lot of time to learn all these things. But on a more down-to-earth level, the general principle here is that if one wants to help other people, and especially if one wants to establish a dharmic connection with them, the more means of communication one has at one's disposal, the more effectively one can fulfil that task. The 4th great vow is, may I lead all beings to Buddhahood. This is the ultimate aim, and the Bodhisattva works towards it by teaching, by example, and by the silent communication of his or her influence. Perhaps that is all we can know and all we need to know for the time being. Together, these 4 great vows constitute the heart of the Mahayana, the heart even of Buddhism itself. And as the practical expression of the bodhicitta in terms of the life and work of the individual bodhisattva, they create the foundation of his or her whole subsequent spiritual career.